Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is August 3rd, 2004. Today's session number is MOJ 2004-02. Today's speaker is John Moeller. The lesson for today is Politics as the Way We the People Summon Out What We Shall Be, Politics and Prudence. Let's listen in.
Again, for people who might not have been here before, my name is John Moeller, and I teach political science at Luther College. And this week I've been trying to focus on the idea of politics is the way that we collectively decide what we're going to become. Very briefly, what I suggested yesterday was I laid out kind of a theory of politics in which I argued that politics is the master science, the language Aristotle uses, that politics is the activity whereby we can bring different points of view, different ways of looking at the world, part of an ongoing conversation to talk about our shared norms, direct society, what our ends ought to be. And then I suggested that politics really, one way of defining it, was a series of components. And you see, this is all nicely laid out for a student who has to memorize 5 or 6 points for this or that. That's sort of the way I think in the way of presenting things. And so I talked about the idea that politics involves accommodation, that politics recognizes that there are competing goods, not a single good, but a multiplicity of goods, and so we have to accommodate those. That politics is principled, that there are certain core principles and certain principles to how we do it. That politics is empirical, that it involves that it recognizes that there are sort of concrete realities. We have to compromise sometimes the principles with the empirical reality. I suggested that politics involves an ongoing conversation, a conversation that's not a particular moment in time, but that continues over a period of time. And I suggested that politics evolves over time, how we do politics, how we think about it, and so forth. What I wanted to do today is, and I think this will involve a lot more discussion, because I think it's something that probably lots of people here have thought about, have had personal choices to make about. I wanted to talk a little bit about what for me is really the most interesting, or one of the most interesting things about politics, and that is the tension between principle and the empirical reality. How do we somehow combine principled beliefs in politics, but with the reality of the world in which we live? And a couple of things to maybe set the stage with that, and then I want to give you a question you can think about. First of all, yesterday some people were talking about or raised the question about groups that are passionate about their beliefs and sort of single-minded. And I think to put a positive spin on that, oftentimes that reflects a very deep, principled set of beliefs that, not unlike the abolitionists of the 19th century, that I am so convinced that this is so central to what a good society is like that I'm going to do whatever I can do to bring about change here. I teach courses, or one course in environmental politics, and this is always one of the interesting questions that I address with students, because there is a certain group of environmentalists who are so absolutely committed to preserving the environment that sometimes they're willing to do things that actually cause people destruction, you know? We'll put some spikes in those trees so that they can't be cut down. Or we'll go out and we'll release these mink from this farm and let them survive. Of course, now they're probably going to die anyway because they're domesticated. But the point being, oftentimes I think this impasse we've had in politics, curiously, is a result of kind of an increased principled nature of politics. And I think part of the reason politics may be so divided today is because different groups are so principled. It's not that they're totally intolerant, but they just can't see any other way because they think that they've figured it out. So that, I think, may be part of what's going on there. And I also think about this about, it must have been 14 years ago, I think. I took a group to Washington, D.C. in I have to use Washington, D.C. Last night I referred to Washington. And, what do you bring classes from Luther College to Washington for? And I realized that we've got to be a little more careful. I take them to Washington, D.C., the nation's hub of activity. Not that Washington State isn't a good place. But and we talked to a Luther graduate who had just made partner in a fairly prestigious law firm. He had been a religion and economics major in college. He had graduated from the college before I started teaching there. Came from a family that had been very active in the church. And his assignment at that point in time in the law firm was this was the point in time where the savings and loans were being bailed out by the government because of activities that a newspaper reader suggested. They certainly hadn't been carefully enough in my estimation, and I had second thoughts about the degree to which they ought to be bailed out, but things are a lot more complicated. And he was expressing to us sort of this tension between the Luther ethic that he had acquired as a student and had been taught about these principles and these values, and the legal ethic that he was required essentially to represent these clients as a practicing attorney who had been hired by them to provide them with the best representation they could. And in a curious way, as I listened to this, in fact, when he had brought in sandwiches for everyone who were sitting around the seminar table and he was talking about this, in a curious sense, I thought, maybe he's talking to himself as much as he's talking to us about this tension he had found in terms of the set of principles. And one of the great things about a nice liberal arts college, and especially, I think, a college of the church, is you can think hard about a principled way of living, isolated from the daily choices of the world out there. And then in the language, actually, in which Robert Penn Warren ends All the King's Men, he talks about leaving burdens, landing, and going out into the world, to live into the world. And it's a messy world. And he sort of recognized that. So that, for me, sort of sets this really interesting tension between we know what's right, we know what's good, we know what a just society might look like. But boy, how do you get there? And how do you get there when it competes with these empirical realities? Well, let me raise this in the form of a question. And this is from a novel by Ward Just. If you're ever interested in reading good political novels about American politics, I think Ward Just really is the best writer of these things right now. He was a journalist, I think for the old Washington Star. Was a reporter in Vietnam. Actually, about half of his novels deal with international kinds of things. He has one really terrific one that's set during the time of the Vietnam War, and he's got these scenes with these Washington insiders over dinner debating the Vietnam War. I mean, I think he's so on the mark, I'm convinced, for what's going on. This particular one is Jack Gantz. It's a great novel that begins in the 1960s when Jack Gantz is a graduate student studying political science at the University of Chicago, just as the polling and behavioral stuff's getting very active. And so he's involved. They bring in this hotshot statistician to do work for the machine that they don't really need him because they figured everything out, but he does sort of confirm what they've known intuitively and instinctively and by years of practice anyway. And so there's this part of it set then in the 60s around the Kennedy election. And then Jack Gantz goes on to Washington, D.C. to be an insider in the 70s. And then the 80s, he comes back home and he wants to run for the Senate in the state of Illinois. And the novel sort of reaches its central point at the end when he's in a very tough primary with this other woman. And the machine knows that she can't win the general election, but Jack Gantz knows he can't win the primary without the machine's money. And there's, of course, a lot of... I suggested yesterday that, for those who were here, that politics is more like a motion picture than a snapshot. And so all of this decision as to whether or not he's going to take the money from Mozart, who is the machine, is tied with all kinds of connections and interactions for the past 20 years, and he's bound and determined he's not going to take this money. He'd rather lose the election than be beholden to Mozart, because he knows if he takes the money, At any point in time, Mozart's going to be able to call him and say, hey, Jack, you know, I got someone who'd like to talk to you, and he's going to have to let him talk to him and so forth. And at the risk of, it's only a couple of paragraphs, I think it's really great, so let me just read these couple of paragraphs to set the stage. And this all takes place, this final discussion, you know, a couple of weeks left in the campaign, this is the new era of campaigning, he's got to have TV money, and they're out on the golf course playing a round of golf, sort of engaging in this conversation about what's going to take place. And Jack says, I can win without you. No, you can't, Jack. You'll lose. Not by much, but you'll lose. And she'll lose, too, in the general. Then we've all lost. You, me, her, three losers. Jesus, I hate to lose. Sometimes you can't prevent it, and so you swing with it, c'est la vie, and you go on to something else. You love the girl, but the girl doesn't love you back, so you say, all right, there are other girls. And those other girls also got tits and nice smiles. Win all the time, and you know you've bought into an easy game, and who wants that? But if you can prevent it and still lose, you're a horse's ass. You're selfish, you think you're Jesus Christ. You're a stranger, you're living in another world. Because that's not the way we're built here in this region. You know that, Jack. We don't believe in a perfect world here. We go with what we have, and if a man extends his hand, we shake it or cut it off. There's no middle way, and I'm wondering whether you belong in the first team or in a sandbox. Because it sounds to me like you believe in a child's history of the world. Life's dirty, Jack, but of course you know that too. Or you did, maybe you forgot. Mozart lifted his 9-iron and tapped the grass behind the Titleist, then thought better of it, shrugged and picked up the ball. He rolled it on the tips of his fingers, removed a speck of dirt, and measuring the distance to the pin, then he rocked back and forth like a man pitching horseshoes, underhanding the Titleist, lofting it over the bushes and the sand trap and under the fairway, where it bounced twice and rolled onto the green about 8 feet from the cup. And then a couple paragraphs later, if I turned him down, he would regard it as an offense against nature, his own natural law, and he would find a way to exact revenge. And that was what encouraged me to refuse him, to let him know that the game was unimaginably complex and that there was no natural law beyond unpredictability. The universe was in disorder and Mozart and I were a misalliance. He had been buying politicians for 50 years. Politicians were his dearest, closest friends. They came to the weddings of his children and the christenings of his grandchildren. They always needed money, so they came to him as a sick person came to a doctor, money a specific against the fee. There were Mozarts all over America, some better, some much worse, a fundamental part of the system. They were owed an article of their own in the Bill of Rights to the Constitution. He was standing on the green waiting for me. I felt that my life had converged to this moment, that what I would do now would be the sum of my actions in the past. He wanted me to submit to discipline, a novice to his confessor. We had been on the opposite sides of things for so long, I hated him for what he had done to Bailey, or what I imagined he did, having no first-hand knowledge of anything. And at that, I would be his last prize before retirement, the old scoundrel's final fix. But I wanted the other two. It was also the sum of my actions, for better and worse. I wanted it as badly as I'd ever wanted anything material, in part as atonement for the years I'd lived on the margins, not evilly, but carelessly and without force or conviction. It was part atonement and part compensation, though that I did not believe I was owed anything. I was not trying to regain something I had lost, but to seize something I had never had. I feared that my goal was beyond reach and the campaign lost. He knew he could do good, but he had to win that election. So what do you think? I mean, and I know you don't know all the stuff here, but you've had these same kinds of dilemmas. I mean, some of you maybe have run for office. What do we do with that? Yeah.
Well, that's the age-old question, I guess. And it's a, if you ask people today if they voted for Jimmy Carter in 1980, I think he won by the re-election by 80%. But the person, here's the person that had all these values, but Ronald Reagan had the family values and all that perception, you know, the perception they made. Jimmy Carter wasn't probably grounded in the reality, you know, that you were talking about, and of course there were economic bad times, but, and he lost. You know, that's the way it is. I had occasion, another example in 1982, I guess, or 84, as a treasurer for Governor Earl of Wisconsin, running for re-election against really a nobody named Tommy Thompson, who's now Secretary of Health. But the issue became putting a prison next to the ballpark in Milwaukee, where the most of the prison population came from, and the workers would be minorities and so forth. And Tommy Thompson did negative ads, and at that time negative ads weren't that common. And they had a picture of the prison being juxtaposed on the ballpark. Do you want this in Wisconsin? And everybody's telling Governor Earl, says, well, fight this, you know. And he said, no, the prison should be there, and not on the ballpark, but next to it, you know. And I said, and he didn't want to go negative. You know, he wanted to be, well, he lost. And, you know, and maybe Wisconsin was better for him. You know, I'm not going to take sides here, but I mean, it's really a tough, and you know, you have to be Machiavellian, I guess, to be successful in politics, and maybe it's for the good of society, you know. You know, for people like Gandhi would disagree, said the means are important, how you win, you know, it's worth a lot, you don't ever win without worthy means of winning, you know, and but maybe he was doing that for appeal. You know, there's people who say that too. But I really, that's one thing that always confuses me. I'd like to believe that we don't do that. But realistically, you know, like you were pointing out yesterday and just now, you maybe can't do good unless you do bad first.
So do you think that...
If that's bad. You know,
so good can come out of bad.
Well, you know, where the Milton and Areopagitica said you have to know, before you know truth, you have to know evil. I mean, you can't, you know, it's that sort of that type of thing.
You know, before we continue, let me, because I was going to do this later, I just want to read one other passage from, actually, my favorite.
This lady has even that too.
Well, I just want to say that it seems like this is a symptom of the system being flawed. I mean, the system is set up so that, not to be sexist, but wealthy white male, Protestant males at the higher levels are the candidates that can win, being backed by the machine. And not only that, they have to be backed by the machine and they have to be reelected several times before they get any power to make decisions. So even if you come in with ideals, you have to be able to stay in to be able to affect those changes, and the system itself basically defeats any hope of you know, making a difference until you become that powerful person. You get on the right committees, you get on the right commissions, and again, that takes at least two or three re-elections. So again, the machine has got you. By that time, the machine's got you so in their pocket that.
All right. So you're saying that. The system requires you to, in this case, for Jack to take the money.
Mm-hmm. Unless you're independently wealthy, yes.
And the consequence of that, though, is, and then are you suggesting, secondly, that it's increasingly difficult to remain principled in your activities because it becomes a series of choices like that in which the system essentially...
Well, you have to be reelected until you get any position of power to make important decisions. Be on the finance committee or the appropriations committee, or you know, so you have to have seniority to get on those commissions generally, or know somebody, we get a freshman, you know, position on those. So again, you need to be reelected, and you're constantly looking towards reelection. And again, unless you're independently wealthy, you're going to have to go to those funders.
John, let me just give my take on this dilemma that Jack is in. It's not such a bad dilemma. I mean, he could either take the money, and then when they make the phone call, he said, heck with you, I'm not going to, maybe by then he'll be in a better position. Or he could refuse the money, lose the election, and he's done something to break the power of the machine. which probably has never happened to them before, and he's made change that way too.
They'll just back another person. The machine backs both sides.
Well, except you're,
you know.
Right, but except you're right. In this situation, the machine will almost certainly lose with the woman candidate. Right, so it would be a kind of, he'd be able to spite the machine for this one election.
But the other side has a machine too,
uh-huh.
So the machine wins no matter what
uh-huh.
right now.
There aren't many machines now, though.
Yeah, there are.
Yeah. Living 40 miles from Chicago.
Not like in the 1970s.
Dennis Pastor-Speaker House is my representative, and I've known him since he was a wrestling coach and a social studies teacher in the neighboring town. My opinion of Dennis Pastor was never very high.
Was he a good wrestling coach, though?
The kids liked it. Illinois politics is so, it's such a mess, and has been forever, that this poor man, if he doesn't take this money, he's a dead duck. I can just tell you that. Right now, Barack Obama is the bright shining star. He's taking Fitzgerald, who was a Republican but was independently wealthy, didn't take any machine money, did his own thing, he did his own voting. The Republicans could not count on him. But now, right now, the Republican candidate who won in the primary, there was such a scandal about him and his divorce that right now they have no candidate. So it's kind of interesting as to who's going to run against Barack Obama, because right now nobody knows. So it's
I think
Illinois politics is just a terrible mess.
What's happening is because they're pulling together all the intelligence. The president used to do searches on the FBI files and stuff and use them later against people to manipulate him or help his guys up with intelligence data about an individual, the dirt and all that stuff. And now they're all getting merged together, so a guy can't really hide because all the agencies are contributing to one place. And that's changed the politics, I hear, from being back there.
Yeah, I think what really compounds this, although it's nothing new, traditionally we think the church should lead in morality, and I think we would agree with that still today. The other factor is, because of the way the politics is, government is being forced to make political decisions on morality. The hot button issues today, of course we all know, are abortion, birth control, genetic research, marriage, and one other. So I would love to hear what the theologians in the group think about what the church's role should be, and why isn't it a stronger role, and why is it the government seems to be forced to be on the forefront of these issues? And of course, historically, we know how strong the Catholic Church was in Europe on all of these moral issues and being in bed politically. So it's not new, the situations change. So politically speaking, how do we separate this since we believe so strongly in church and state?
Well, Paul Simon was our senator who was a Lutheran and was a very, I think, probably one of the most moral politicians that we've ever elected from Illinois, and he used to come out and speak. I mean, he was always there. He could come and attend our church unannounced, you know, and things like that. And so you got to know, if you followed him at all and were believing in him, you got to know what he had to say. And one time he finally retired, he said, "It's money has become so important in campaigning that I'm spending all of my time trying to raise money, and this is stupid. I can't do what I want to do, and so I'm retiring." And that's what he said, money had become the god of the politics.
It still is.
Oh, okay, so.
And that's because you have to be reelected every few years. If you had a longer term, maybe you wouldn't want to be reelected, or maybe you could do 2 or 3 years of work and then work on reelection. I mean, so again, it comes back to the system for me.
Okay, but then the question becomes, doesn't it? We could all agree that money has, let's even use the word corrupted, politics. And we could all agree that that all ought to change. But what I'm interested in is this moment, when it hasn't changed, what then do I do? And I suppose, you know, in a real interesting sense for me, and I think of the issue that sometimes being a good person is different than, let's say, being a good citizen. Because
because sometimes good citizenship requires maybe a certain obedience that runs contrary to what you would simply do if you think this is the right thing to do. But my question then becomes, recognizing that it's 2004 and this is the situation we have, should one muddy one's hands and get involved in that and probably sacrifice some of one's maybe personal principles, take that money, or is it better to, in a sense, wash one's hands of it and walk away from it? Perhaps, as Carl said, walking away might do some good thing because it does a little bit of damage to the machine. But how does one, you know, if you decide that I agree that politics is the master science and I need to be part of that, and if the reality is, the way it works today is you have to be able to get elected, and that requires a certain amount of money. Whether or not it's a machine, it still requires money for advertisements and so forth. How does one begin to address that dilemma? Does one?
I think Paul, when Paul Wellstone was originally elected, he had a pretty strong grassroots movement that relied heavily just on individual contributions and that type of thing.
He was an underdog who won with a lot smaller amount of money than his opponent by running a creative campaign. Yeah.
He was going to only do two terms. He vowed he would only do two terms, but then he did end up running for this term. But he seemed to be a person who was able to have a lot of, he's a very ethical person in terms of the kinds of things that he stood for. And I don't know how much he had to, give up his principles in order to get there. It seemed like he was doing it without doing that, but of course you don't know what's going on behind the scenes.
And would it bother you if you found out that he, sort of cut a corner here or did something here because the kinds of things he did, both publicly speaking and working toward legislation, was good enough to make those kinds of judgments?
I'm sorry, who are you talking about?
Paul Wellstone.
Oh, sure.
Senator from Minnesota.
I mean, is that okay?
I have seen diving in with the bad crowd and swimming with them. If you're trying to do something else, you might have to do that just to surface, is what you're saying, just to surface and do some good. And in Tacoma, we have this place called the Tacoma Club, and in the early 70s, the Supreme Court justices would come down there and party. Gambling wasn't legal, but there were gambling tables, prostitution, and heavy drinking, like college drinking, because the local boys wanted something done in the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. So I saw a total breach of government because everything kind of gets focused in there. But later I saw that the stuff they were working on became a real good and international effort that was better than the corruption that was like aggregated all around the country. They were trying to pull something together. Mm-hmm. They kind of had to get in there and
so the danger is danger is you then yourself become
part of it, the Supreme Court guys, but the women, since they've entered the Supreme Court and had more influence, it seems to be kind of leveling out. I keep track of that, and I think that the women in politics have helped balance and make it more ethical, where those men wouldn't have been down there because they would have had a woman with them too, going, what is going on here? So that's kind of helped diminish those quick fixes and cheaper fixes with money than a broader political.
Uh-huh.
So the Supreme Court breaches are big in my mind.
Uh-huh.
You know, this gentleman talked tonight about, what do the theologians say and where are we at in the church and to hold up some kind of integrity and ethics with all that. You know, I think biblically speaking, I look at Nathan the prophet, that would go to King David and say, you're the man. You're the one that did this. They were at that kind of tension. Anymore, at least my understanding, with the present administration in Washington, D.C., that you can surround yourself, or at least the president to some degree, with the religious right or those who say or agree with maybe an approach that the administration is following, rather than someone who may stand up and to hear some opposite voices. And at least with our ELCA bishop and some of the mainline churches, you know, who do you want to hear? Do you want to hear someone who agrees or someone who can somehow at some point say, you know, this is wrong, we need to take a look at this, will you consider that? But that they don't even have audience at this point in order to have access because our president has insulated himself with those voices that agree with the position. Now, I may be wrong with that, but I think there's an element of truth with all of that. And I think that's what's so frustrating, you know, at least from the biblical perspective, that there is that kind of tension that the prophet can say at some point, you need to look at it, take a hard look at what's going on.
Let me follow up from that with a statement. Some of you may remember, and let me ask you what you think about this. You may remember 1984, Mario Cuomo gave an address at the University of Notre Dame, but it was a fairly famous address because he addressed the issue of abortion at, you know, a fairly major Catholic university. And at this point, he was still the governor of New York, and I think a lot of people thought one day he might run for the presidency. In fact, sometimes I thought it was a failure of nerve that probably kept him from running for the presidency. And I think there was a point where a lot of people figured he could very well end up on the Supreme Court and would become sort of a public intellectual in a way that he's been rather invisible, it seems to me, though I did see him on TV the other day being interviewed in something. And he was talking in this talk, he was the issue again for him. He said, I'm a Catholic. I follow the Pope when it comes to how I live my life. We would never have an abortion in our family. But can I take this particular truth, this principle that I know to be true, that abortion is bad, and can I then carry that idea over to the political world and advocate that? Or in fact, as the governor of New York, do I have to think of myself as kind of a bifurcated person? I'm a Catholic in my private life, I'm the governor of New York in my public life, and this attitude on abortion doesn't carry over into the public life. And he suggests, he uses the word prudence, actually, as a way of addressing at what point these principles could come into play. And then he goes back and he talks about the Catholic bishops during the period leading up to the Civil War. And he says, but the truth of the matter is, few, if any, Catholic bishops spoke for abolition in the years before the Civil War. It wasn't, I believe, that the bishops endorsed the idea of some humans owning and exploiting other humans. Pope Gregory XVI in 1840 had condemned the slave trade. Instead, it was a practical political judgment that the bishops made. They weren't hypocrites, they were realists. At the time, Catholics were a small minority, mostly immigrants, despised by much of the population, often vilified and the object of sporadic violence. In the face of a public controversy that aroused tremendous passions and threatened to break the country apart, the bishops made a pragmatic decision. They believed their opinions would not change people's minds. Moreover, they knew they were Southern Catholics, even some priests who owned slaves. They concluded that under the circumstances, arguing for a constitutional amendment against slavery would do more harm than good, so they were silent, as they have been generally in recent years on the question of birth control, and as the church has been on even more controversial issues in the past, even ones that dealt with life and death. What is relevant to the discussion is that the bishops were making judgments about translating Catholic teachings into public policy, not about the moral validity of the teachings. In so doing, they grappled with the unique political complexities of their times. The decisions they made to remain silent on a constitutional amendment to abolish slavery or on the repeal of the fugitive slave laws wasn't a mark of their moral indifference. It was a measured attempt to balance moral truths against political realities. I mean, I have read this speech and this passage probably 50 times, and 25 times I have agreed with Cuomo, and 25 times I have disagreed with Cuomo. is he right to defend the Catholic bishops here, or did the Catholic bishops, I mean, were the abolitionists the good guys, or were the Catholic bishops making a prudential decision that seems to you to make sense, and we could translate this into all kinds of issues today in terms of how you get results, what the costs are. What's your response to that judgment by Mario Cuomo? And again, by the way, he's sort of talking to himself as much as he's talking to the crowd at Notre Dame. I mean, he's writing that speech, explaining and figuring out why it's okay for me to believe this when I go to church and confess, but not to translate that into the political realm when we're bringing about public policy.
Turning that inverse a little bit, it can be a disaster from a theological Christian point of view if we got enveloped by the state. And in a way, maybe Cuomo wasn't thinking this way, but that's what he was doing, really, you know. And that has been an age-old thing. Augustine wrestled with this, and of course he came with the tale of the city of God, the city of man, and so forth. And Cuomo, I believe, even played in that from the speech of the Democratic Convention. And it allowed Christianity to keep on developing as an institution into the Middle Ages and, against the power of the kings and the secular rulers and so on. But I think as Christians you have to make sure, you really have to be open to discussion on all issues. You can't get mired in one mindset all the time because that isn't the way it has been. And in the secular world, we're statistically one of the great Christian nations because we've kept the separation of church and state. Where you really can believe, I mean, not just have a mindset that's in line with the state. And that kind of worries me, and that's why I like Cuomo's ideas. It worries me that more and more there's this idea that we should accept some of the predominant views of a certain group of Christians today is, so we don't want to have a president who hasn't been a born-again Christian, perhaps, in some states, in some parts of the state. That's, so if I'm running for president in those areas, I say, yeah, I'm born again. And I know Jesus Christ is my personal savior, put a mystical quality to it. Other parts of the United States are not buying into that necessarily, but I don't know, I don't think, a lot of times I don't think things change. There's always been these issues throughout history, but the religion one is getting a little more serious now, I think, where the state and the church are getting too close. There's an envelopment taking place a little bit, and I worry about that.
And you are right, Cuomo does talk about that. I mean, that is one of the whole arguments he makes here, why the church shouldn't do this. Then it can come back to haunt the church. Yeah.
I think that our culture wants to see or does see everything in a dichotomy, that there has to be a good and a bad, and that there's, that you can actually divide things that way, when in fact life is so much more complex than that, that people have to make hard decisions about what's best for the common good, which is the greater good. When you can't choose between, this is the perfect right and this is the perfect wrong, because our life is too messy for that. And so each person just has to discern whether doing this thing will result in a greater good than doing that thing, and then know whether they have the integrity to, when they get to the next stage, to not give in over and over and over again, but yet still always keep that greater good in mind.
I would agree with that there you need to, be open to the greater good, but when do you, even though the result may be a greater good, if it goes against some moral absolute, I think that's the question, is like where are the moral absolutes that you absolutely, that you should not break despite their, a resulting greater good? you know, I mean, and I don't know what those are.
Would you think each of us sort of figures out different points there, or is it can be discerned that there, this is the point that...
Well, I think, I mean, I don't know, that's the question. Are there,
uh-huh,
are there moral absolutes that are not negotiable?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I think a lot of people believe that, oh, that's okay for you, but it's not okay for me, that there's some kind of, that most things, you know, are just kind of on a continuum and you decide where you are. But, you know, it seems to me that, that ultimately there are some moral absolutes that that should not be, you know, not be disregarded.
Right.
I mean, the Bill of Rights is pretty core to, I mean, it's not, I know that's an initial guiding principle that we have in the country that way, but I think, yeah, absolutely.
I would just want to say the greater good for who? Because there's always that issue of who is the greater good for?
Mm-hmm.
Now, when the United States government overthrew the monarchy in Hawaii, that Queen Liliuokalani abdicated because she felt that the Hawaiians did not have the resources to fight the United States government. Grover Cleveland agreed with us that this was an overthrow, this was illegal, this should not happen. But the sugar planters and the business interests, he couldn't fight them. So the government is overthrown. So then now, 100 years later, who is it the greater good for? I mean, who knows who is the greater good for? All she said was, and she was a Christian, that there would be a lot of blood shed and they would not prevail. So why should I put my people through this?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the greater good gets complicated when you hear stories like Jesus goes after the one sheep. It's, you know, it's not mm-hmm. just simple number majority, but that one
mm-hmm.
is important,
mm-hmm.
and you sacrifice the 99.
Mm-hmm.
That's complicated.
Yeah, and I just read Martin's book on Martin Luther, and I just finished the chapter where the peasants revolt in Germany on the basis of what Martin Luther is teaching, but Martin Luther doesn't side with them. He sides with princes because he feels like the chaos would be worse. So again, here he kind of starts something and...
But there seems to be a time for everything. I mean, you know, 20 years ago, we would never be talking about gay marriage, unions, things like that. I think there has to be a grassroots behind every battle, every issue, before it can, you know, before that one person or persons can feel comfortable enough to put their neck out and bring it up politically into the political machine. Because, you know, if you had a battle in Hawaii when you can't win,
why do it?
Yes. Why do it? You know, why bring up gay marriage 20 years ago when you're just going to, you know, be shot down? I mean, I think there's a time and place for every issue. And, you know, I think, again, it has to be a populist movement versus necessarily a political movement.
I think worldwide that it's the woman's era for power and moving up, because they're moving around and trying to educate them in foreign countries and set up schools. And I think it's the political machine is saying that the women and the changes that occur internationally and here, the pressures they feel here, would be good for the rest of society also. And I think it's a time where people are planning and investing in the women. And I see it in microbanking and all of these.
I don't think we're there yet.
No,
we're getting there.
What I'm saying is there
empower.
I mean,
when there's 13 versus...
Yeah,
you know.
I just think it's time they're starting to empower them and moving up in the huge.
Well, there's a sociological factor going on. That is simply that the baby boomers have had the most power throughout all the time that we've existed. I'm a pre-baby boomer, I'm a little older than that, but what I've observed is, and what is generally physiologically true, is that men, as we get older, become more nurturing, less out there in the world, and women, because their estrogen changes, become more testosteronized, relatively, and often women have not had a career, so points well taken that it is a time for women to step up, take some power, and run with it. Let us men sit back and take care of the home fires, man. I'm happy to do that.
I recall the question about moral absolutes came up. It called a section of a Christian ethics course I had at seminary, and I actually can only remember three quarters of it. There were 4 points, and I remember three of them, that people approach Christian ethics in such different ways that to have a moral absolute just doesn't seem possible. And there are people like Immanuel Kant that are deontologists, that there is a solid absolute, there is a law, and then that's your center. There are teleologists, telos is a Greek word meaning the end. Mm-hmm. So you're looking, it's sort of Machiavellian, not exactly, that's how I remember that. If it's greater chaos this way, you're going to take this, even though right now that seems like not such a good thing, but down the line, so you're looking, sort of, you're linear in your ethics in a way, you're looking down the line. And then there's the situation ethicist that doesn't want to say anything until he or she has all the details of the situation, has read the context, and says, depending upon this, this may be the best thing, but this does not translate at all into another situation. You have to start over and find out the issues and the context in that other situation. I can't remember the fourth. Does anybody know? But
consequentialist, maybe?
No, I cannot remember that.
I would have been. It could have been a good fourth, you know?
It could be, but that's why, because everybody's approaching their... It's just not equal. Everybody's approaching that from their gut differently. What matters? Is it right now? Is it way off into the future? Is it those moral absolutes that I learned as a young Catholic? I mean, what is it? We're approaching, the process is different. That's the complexity, I think.
No, I think you're right. And that's the reason, it seems to me one of the, you keep having to push back to fundamental questions. And so in a sense, I think what that asks, what's the end of a good society? And so Machiavelli uses prudence in a different way than Aristotle uses it, because for Machiavelli, the end of a good society is an ordered society. And so the leader who is prudent is the leader who can act in a way to create, bring about an ordered society. Whereas Aristotle is much more of a telos in terms of what a good society looks like. And so there, prudential judgment is based on a person of moral character who has a fuller understanding of what's good and how you get there. And so, I mean, you're right. That's why all these things are so complicated, because a good ruler, it seems to me, how you define a good ruler depends on what is the end that you're ruling for, and that leads to different kinds of ethics and different kinds of things like that. Yeah.
Speaking from the West Coast, where we have very few churched people that attend church, I think are in the 6% in Washington State. That was 8% maybe, not unlike the Midwest. But I think we need a public relations campaign to counter the fact that the big right politically has associated itself so strongly with the fundamentalist right. Not that either one of those is necessarily a black and white wrong, but every non-Christian friend, and I have a considerable number of non-Christian friends, way more than Christian friends, because that's just the way it is, thinks that Christianity naturally is associated with right, is associated with the political statements that the right has to say, and that politically, I think we should step up and say what diversity Christianity offers, because the non-Christians aren't getting it. They're going through the political system. This is just my opinion in the West Coast, this is a Northwest provincial. But that's what my very smart friends think. I think they think that we're all rightists.
To clarify, when you say non-Christians, do you mean people that are non-Christian, or do you mean people that are not attending a church?
These would be both.
Because most people have attended churches from the time they were.
Yeah, I think 70% of the people believe in God in the U.S. I'm just doing some demographic stuff off the top of my head, which might be wrong. But it's just my perception among the group in northwestern Washington where I reside that it's very frustrating having to say, no, that's not what I feel Christ taught. Christ taught this.
I think there are some Christians that believe that also.
Well, that's the problem. That's what I was just saying, that they focus on the, if you make a lot of money, well, God must be on your side, yeah. Type of theology. And to counter that, it's tough because they're so into the political, the politics of power. Power equals money, influence, that it's difficult for them to get out of that winner-takes-all mentality and get into the what I feel is the Christian mentality, the more the servant mentality. And they only will see that, I'm talking too long, but they'll see that in Eastern religion, they'll see that in Buddhism, much more than they'll see that in Christianity. So I think we need a makeover.
And do you think it's really difficult for someone with that kind of set of beliefs to actually step into the political arena and get involved?
Do you mean as a Christian or as a non-Christian?
As a Christian. I mean, is there Caesar's coin?
Render under Caesar's type of thing, the New Testament types of statements. I'm not a theologian at all, unlike most of the people in the room, I think, here. But it's just some random thoughts from the Northwest Washingtonian.
Well, I think your point expands beyond, too, because, I mean, current day and in past, politicians and presidents use religion as a weapon. I mean, they use it as a justification for their causes, and that may be just to get the supporters they need, but you know, how many things have been, you know, justified in the name of God that are, in my opinion, very non-Christian? I mean, particularly Bush, in my opinion, right now, is, you know, justifying the war as, you know, we are this oligarchy city on the hill, and, you know, we are blessed, and God's blessing everything I'm doing. And that's so wrong. And to have not have a background in Christianity to be able to understand that that's not correct is doing a major disservice to Christianity.
Let me ask you, is that a Christian problem, or is that a problem in general with a person who brings, whether it be a natural law or a higher principle, position to the arena? So in other words, is a natural law thinker who's convinced that maybe homosexuality is wrong or that abortion is wrong, is convinced that the environment has this protection that's absolutely necessary? I mean, in general, are you wary of people bringing absolutely principled arguments to the political stage, or is there something special about Christian claims to truth that are discouraging and worrisome for you?
Well, particularly going to war against evil, you know, these evil people, you know, uh-huh. Where is he getting that? That's not a Christian concept of, you know, I mean, he's saying, you know, they're sinners and they're bad and they're evil, and who's he to judge? And it's not that he has a policy or that he has a belief, but that he's justifying actions on it independently.
Because he's gotten Christianity wrong? I mean, could someone respond to him and say, so is the problem, you're saying, not that someone brought a principle of belief, but he got it wrong, and here's really what Christianity requires us to do. Is that?
And there's not a voice, really, uh-huh. You know, a major voice saying, yes, he's got it wrong. You know, that, you know, this is not why we're going to war. This is not Christianity. This is not our, you know, beliefs.
So it's okay to have the discussion involve what Christianity advocates. Mm-hmm. So that's not the problem. It's not the problem of bringing religious beliefs. It's just this guy's got it wrong, and here's what Christianity really, really requires.
What if there was an expansion of a person of faith bringing that to the table? And like you said, the moral issues are abortion, gay marriage. But to me, the issues are economic justice, mm-hmm. fair wages, and why are people in poverty, and health care. To me, those are the moral issues that, as a Christian, I want to see. And, you know, John Kerry, in his speech, said, I'm not going to wear my faith on my sleeve or something. And would he be caving in if he started to play that religion part, you know, informing him as a person?
What do you think?
The same way that book said money, you know, would he be caving in?
What do you think? I mean,
well, I think it would bring, I'm from the Northwest too, and I think it would expand the idea of what it means to be a person of faith and what are the moral issues.
Mm-hmm. See, I think it's a very savvy position for him to take in that he, when you come to the table with solid principles that you lay out, which is what the media wants now, what they're telling the public that they should want is a black and white position on everything, you tie your hands politically, that you don't leave yourself any sort of options to discuss or think about any issues in the future. If you, you know, on national television proclaim that you have a position, I think he realizes, and I think any savvy politician should come to the understanding that will, in fact, come back and haunt them later on when they are forced with looking at something from a different perspective.
You can't change your mind. You have to be right. I mean, this is what I think is wrong right now, is that ultra-conservatives of anything, whether it's Islam, Christianity, whatever, they are so positive that they are right and everybody is wrong. If you don't believe exactly like they do, you are wrong. And that you can't change your mind. You can't be flexible. You can't. If you voted 12 years ago for something and now you're taking a different side, you are wrong. I mean, this is terrible. And they're going to throw it up in your face. And
the same thing does happen on the way left end, though. The way
left
ultra-liberal, any extreme.
It kind of takes away the whole, you know, when you're talking about politics as a process and a thing, that, you know, having that firm stand kind of takes away the entire process aspect of it and just makes a decree.
Yeah.
You know, it takes away the discussion.
It's an imperialistic view, I think, on that.
Getting back to your point here, what does Jack...
Actually, he does take the money, and which is not surprising from Ward Just's view of the world. I mean, he thinks that you know, it's necessary to play the game, to be able to do well in the game, and so he does actually. Take the money.
You know, there is also a real world example of that same situation in Ralph Nader's, you know, pursuit. You know, he absolutely did not waver, and you know, in his result, I'm sure he couldn't have been happy with the result of his causes, you know, as a result of his own actions. So mysterious and
yeah, I think you're right. I mean, Nader is a great example of, and again, maybe, you know, I mean, we can judge him. I ultimately have to decide for ourselves based on these various discussions, and I agree. There is no formula. There is no, this is why this is maddening for students, because they want the formula. Give it to me so I can plug it in and I can figure it out. But I do also think at the same time, we have a right to sit back and think through this carefully and make a judgment about whether Nader's doing the right thing or not. He's living by his principles. He's gonna live and die a principled man. Is that good? Or will that, in fact, if in fact that did impact an election, is it better to live and die a principled man if you maybe have had other consequences? These are one of my favorite historical figures then is Lemuel Shaw, who was a judge in Massachusetts around the time of the Civil War. And actually, Herman Melville lived with that family for a couple of years. And when you know that, then Billy Budd, if you've ever read the short novel, it all makes a lot of sense. Lemuel Shaw hated slavery. But he was a judge on the Massachusetts court. And every time a fugitive slave would come in there, he'd send him back. And it killed him to do that. And he would go home and he would struggle over this, talk about it over the dinner table. But when he put on that black robe, you know, he said, this is what I have to do. And these are those kinds of I mean, it's sort of Nader in a reverse. These are the kinds of judgments, it seems, that people have to make.
Just a comment about Nader. Interesting, I never thought about this before, that we might think, say, if he's a teleologist, maybe would say, just the means doesn't matter, it's the end. We've got to get to the end. But Nader could still be a teleologist. Bigger picture.
Right.
He's looking to a bigger picture end. And
this
means is to die a principled man, maybe someone else in the next generation. Well, that's a bigger end. And for right now in his life, he may never have have this end of election as president, but down the line he may be setting the pace for something.
Too bad he's not like the queen. That's for the better good.
Well, yeah,
but his end could be recognition of a third party.
That's true.
Yeah, exactly.
That's true.
Okay, yeah, right. Yeah.
So
I would say that Tariq Aziz, the Christian prime minister of Iraq, told the truth to everyone and gave everyone exactly what information he had, and it was all accurate and found to be accurate after we entered. He stuck to his principles, and you know that he didn't have the political. Well, he didn't have the political connection. I'm just saying they looked at that, but he looped in and out of the Pope's office and all over the place, trying to convince everybody that, you know, what do we do here? I just know him from the 80s when he worked at GE. So.
Can you read us the quote that you were
going to
read us?
Oh, no, I was going to read you earlier. my favorite political novel ever, of course, is All the King's Men. And if you've never read it, you just have to read it. And actually, I happen to have this here. I wasn't going to bring it, but my daughter's reading it now. And so I was able to look up the great quote where early in the novel, Willie Stark, who's the Huey Long character, is trying to persuade this person to act in a particular way, and he says, "Dirt's a funny thing," the boss said. "Come to think of it, there ain't a thing but dirt on this green God's globe, except what's underwater, and that's dirt too. It's dirt makes the grass grow. A diamond ain't a thing in the world but a piece of dirt that got awful hot. And God Almighty picked up a handful of dirt and blew on it and made you and me and George Washington and mankind blessed in faculty and apprehension. It all depends on what you do with the dirt." That right?
Yeah.
And there's a great documentary by Ken Burns in which Robert Penn Warren, about 85 years old at the time, reading that passage. It's absolutely wonderful. So, yeah, there you go. Well, thanks.
And